2015, an elite DFS Army Commando unit formed to bring high-level DFS strategy to the masses. Today, aided by DFS sharks and lineup sellers alike, they continue their quest to turn Joe into DFS pro.
Good morning, everybody. This is the Daily Dispatch, and you are about to get your orders brought to you from DailyFantasyAdvice.net. We are the DFS Army. I am your host, Boomer's Daddy, and joining me is my lovely, my Michael Strahan, if you will, wow. My Kelly, the Chopadon.
Wow.
How are you doing this morning, Chop?
I do not know where to go with that. I mean, if you would have just called me Vanna White or some shit, I might have just disconnected and been done.
I got to give you a little bit more than credit than Vanna White does. She just sits there and touches the hieroglyphic numbers or letters and looks pretty. So I got one little thing here before we get going. We've got a great show for you guys planned today. I'm going to bust over the topics before I get into my little two-part rant. We're going to go over the FanDuel scoring, the new FanDuel scoring that takes effect today, kind of exactly how to handle that and how to kind of predict that a little bit. Then we're going to go over cash game lineup building strategies, kind of break it down per position, what we're looking for, what we like to target, and give you some examples in that as well. And then we are going to wrap it up with a little bit of a kind of a, something that me and Al have been doing on the live show that's been a lot of fun. We're gonna do a dong predictor, Chop.
Hey, I like it. I'm good. I already got him picked out.
Okay, I got two little quick things that I want to get into. I'm a big, big proponent of watching whatever sport I'm in. I'll watch that network, whether it be MLB, NFL, or NBA. I'll watch that network because where I truly 100% believe that former players don't know crap about fantasy, I don't listen to them as far as fantasy purposes are concerned, like who's a good value in this and that and whatever. What I do listen to them at, for are little nuances of the game and stuff like that. And I was watching Quick Pitch last night, as I always do, while I'm up with my, I guess he's 3.5 weeks now. Three and a half weeks. I was up with my 3.5-week-old son last night, and I was watching Quick Pitch, and Heidi Watney is she's an unbelievable, amazingly beautiful woman. She's kind of like the Aaron Andrews of the MLB Network. But Chop, this would get you going a little bit. She had the hair pulled back, okay, into a little bun, with the ruler basically and the teacher glasses on, a black dress. I kid you not. And she was popping those hips and giving you the looks, and it was like they were freaking starting the beginning of what could have been could have easily turned into a spoof porn real quick.
Dude, where was
and
I?
And if we had sponsors, we probably couldn't go that way. But since we're unsponsorless and we like humor, I can definitely go that way. And I just was sitting there going, wow. And Heidi Watney is, I love her to death to begin with. But I was just like, well, man, that's got my mind running.
I'm going to have more than my mind running. I need to look her up just based on that. I'm not a big, like, teacher fetish guy or whatever, like a lot of dudes are. I'm just kind of just go for overall hotness. And when you say, what'd you say her name was? Heidi Watney?
Yep, Heidi Watney.
The hottest chick on TV that I can think of right now is Molly Karam, the one that's doing the Stephen A. Smith and what's his name on ESPN. But she came over from NFL Network, and she's the only sports gal that I specifically tuned in to watch every morning. So if people don't think sex sells, they need to get over themselves, because for guys like us, I will tune in and watch a hot chick talk football every morning. I don't care what they're talking about. I just want to hear just some good banter back and forth and just stare at the babe.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the reasons why I love listening to ESPN's Fantasy Football Now. Is I love Stefania Bell's voice on that podcast. It's absolutely, I think it's one of the sexiest voices out there.
She sounds a little better than we do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you guys want to go ahead and just turn off our podcast and go listen to her, we're not going to blame you, just as long as you come back to us.
I was going
to
say, what are you doing? Now we're never going to get any sponsors, man. these guys tell people to go away.
Yeah. But, awesome. You know, Heidi Watney, absolutely. And these networks know it. That's why they get these girls that, you know, pop off with, you know, the night shows. And that's why, honestly, that's why ESPN's first daily fantasy advice analyst was a woman, and it was Cynthia Freeland, is because she's easy on the eyes, so to speak. Not that she's ugly by any means, but she's no Heidi Watney. And, you know, men didn't respond to her well, but that was all ESPN's fault. I've chatted with her on Twitter and got to know her a little bit. I don't know her like a lot of people do, or like
Dude.
The people that work with her. Don't get me wrong there, but I have had some conversations with her on Twitter. And
yeah, you don't know her like a lot of people do. I don't know if you just called her a slut or what, but whatever.
No. it's one of those things, like. You know, I've had some conversations with her on Twitter, and she knows her stuff. She's very, very good at breaking it down and analyzing, and she's got some hot takes, and she knows how to work social media. But that's one of the reasons that when ESPN was doing a bunch of their stuff, they kind of went on. They went that route, and it wasn't accepted well in the industry, but that wasn't her fault. That was ESPN's fault, and that's been hashed and rehashed and double hashed. And so, but yeah, sex sells, and that was just something that I wanted to kind of point out there. And if you guys have any of these networks, listen to some of these former players break down like anomalies. Like I was watching MLB Central this morning, and they were breaking down Rich Hill. And, you know, you can take some of that and you can kind of learn from it as far as a fantasy and apply it towards fantasy. You know, that's why I'm a big proponent of watching games, breaking down game film during NFL, watching who's seeing the ball well when they're hitting in MLB. You can watch condensed games if you have the MLB.TV subscription. You know, it's there's a lot of different tools out there, and I love numbers, Chop. You know that just as well as I do, but there is a talent and a skill level involved in being able to see things through broadcasts and through game film that not a lot of people have that eye for. You know, people will just go and they'll look at numbers and they'll be like, oh, well, this guy is showing that he has a, you know, 323 wOBA versus left-handed pitchers at home during the day and on or in a dome, you know, and it's like, dude, seriously, come on. So
are you bashing on my boy Charles Barkley?
Charles Barkley is the biggest idiot.
I know.
But his
commercials with Spike Lee are awesome.
Oh, yeah. He's hilarious. He's fun, and he knows basketball. But when he says that analytics are overused, and you know maybe they are to a point. I think maybe there are some people that you know have that put too much emphasis on the analytical side of you know either basketball, football, baseball, whatever sport have you. you know, with stuff like that. But, you know, it's there's a fine line, and you can take things and use, you know, and use it to your advantage just by being able to watch the game and starting to pick up on things. If you've never really done it before, don't trust your eye right off the bat. Kind of get into it and start learning it. But for me, for baseball especially, something I've been watching since I was probably about two, maybe even sooner than that with my grandfather, knowing him, I can definitely see things that a lot of people, you know, they don't put their trust in. And you'll hear me talk about it in the Slack channel.
You bring up a good point. When you're talking about people that are brand new, not doing this, not jumping in full bore and trusting their eye right away, I think you bring up a really, really good point. I don't know too many people that would just automatically go, I've never looked at this before, but I'm the frickin' bomb. Yet watching these shows and watching baseball games and stuff like that will bring you up to speed. It will speed up your growth curve. I know I talk to a lot of people all the time that say, hey, I really appreciate you sharing me your process and just kind of telling me what you look at and where you look. And well, that's part of it, is watching some of these shows. Watching Baseball Tonight is a very, very common one, but watching some of the more specific shows like you're mentioning as well, and listening to the guys actually break the game down. Turn your volume up. Listen to the play-by-play guys. You'll find some real idiots doing color play-by-play, but occasionally you'll get some really, really good tips from these players and what they're looking for and what they're looking at, and they will talk a little bit about how a pitcher is attacking a hitter or a team of hitters or whatever. That'll speed your growth curve up, because then you'll start understanding, well, oh, just some of these stats are making sense now. The picture is kind of defuzzying on itself. It's kind of becoming a little bit more clear for me.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll get Harold Reynolds last year during the playoffs was a big one.
I love that dude.
And the DFS community hates him, but I love him. And they hate him because he's a former player, and he gets, you know, he goes a little bit over the top at times, but I love him. I've been watching him since he was with ESPN. And it's just one of those things that, you know, when you start to sit there and look at everything, these guys know the game. And not only know the game itself, they know the professional game, which, believe it or not, is a different game than, you know, college, or, and I know that's not breaking any, you know, that's not any breaking news to anybody, any hot take, but there are little nuances that are the same and there are little nuances that are different. So,
yeah, I agree. He said something one time, and every time somebody mentions the name Harold Reynolds, I'll try and make this really quick. He talked about when he was being interviewed as a minor league ball player, and he's one of the youngest brothers in his family of a family of baseball crazies. Now, they didn't make it to the pros, but a lot of them played at, you know, high school, college level and whatnot, and he was the youngest. And so he, at age 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, was forced to play with tougher competition. He got interviewed one time by, I guess, a scout or somebody before he was getting drafted, and he said, I've never been treated like a star. I've never been introduced to any of this limelight-type stuff before. He goes, the guy asked me, he goes, well, how do you think you hit against a, you know, 89-mile-an-hour slider or whatever? And he's, like, lost. He says, I don't know how to answer the question correctly. I don't know what they're listening for. I don't know what they want to hear or any of this. He goes, so I just told him. I said, you know what? I grew up in a family of five brothers, and we played wiffle ball in the backyard every day, and I don't know much about a slider, but I can hit a wiffle slitty like nobody's business. That just made me die. I thought that was a funny thing, because we've all played wiffle ball in the backyard. We've all tried to hit that little wiffle slitty. And when he calls it the wiffle slitty to a professional interview, I was like, oh, I can dig this guy.
Heck yeah. He's real. He keeps it real. And they've got this, just to go on wiffle ball, they've got a new one now out that's absolutely amazing. And you don't have to worry about shredding your elbow trying to throw the sliders or anything. You just throw it from a different arm angle, and it does all the work for you, which I think is awesome, you know, especially for little kids. And they've got its own, you know, bat and power sleeve and stuff like that. And I would love to get some of these guys around, in the DFS Army that, and we just play wiffle ball.
Dude,
so.
I showed a clip. We were talking about it a while back with Al. I showed a clip of these guys that converted their front yard in suburban New York into a wiffle ball stadium. It was a 6-minute video. It was absolutely so well done. But to be honest with you, if you go on YouTube and start listening to some of these guys that take it really, really seriously, my favorite thing is the way they set up the strike zone behind home plate with that little hanging tin pan. When that wiffle ball comes in and you think you're taking a ball because that wiffle ball curves so hard and it rips that pan and goes, pang, that has to be the most disheartening feeling. I would rather be called out in a 40,000-person stadium on strikes on a borderline pitch than have to listen to that thing hit that pie pan behind me, because I'm built up with just that shame. The hanging of the head is just like, there's no debate. It hit the strike zone and you're done.
Yep, exactly. So, all right, let's get into it. My second rant, it's going to have to wait for another day. It'll come up. It basically has to do with the joke that was a strike zone and some people were asking me about that. Well, I might as well just go into it real quick. Not last night, but the night before, the game at Coors Field where the Rockies only scored one run and struck out, like, I think it was 7 or 8 times looking. And Walt Weiss and Ryan Rayburn both got tossed out of the game and stuff like that for arguing balls and strikes. That umpire, his name is, and I'm going to blast this guy, his name is Lance Barrett, okay? And this is not the 90s where we have Greg Maddux and Tom Glavin painting the black and they can get 1.5 to 2 inches off the outside corner of the plate. This literally is, who is the Cuban defector? This is Orlando, not El Duque. This is LeVon Hernandez, Charles Johnson, Florida Marlins-esque. 6 inches off the plate, and it just unbelievable. It's the dude was giving 2 to 3 inches either side of the plate, not just off the outside corner. He was giving it on the inside corner as well. And he was giving it up and down. His strike zone was all over the place. And, like, they were showing, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, these K zones that everybody has, they're, you know, they're made to look, make the look the home team good or the umpires good and stuff like that. This guy, if you go pull up a graph of his balls and strikes calls that game, you will see, I'm going to guess, minimum 20, 25 pitches out of the K zone.
Wow. Okay?
And that changes the complexion of a game.
Oh, absolutely.
When you are trained to have your strike zone, you know, and you can, hitters, they'll always say, give me up, give me down, or give me one side of the plate.
Give me one side, give me an area, but be consistent.
Exactly, be consistent. But don't be all over the place to where you don't, to where we don't know what a strike is going to be.
Right.
And it was absolute, there were, it was bad. And as soon as, like, I thought maybe in the first inning there was a pitch to Francisco Cervelli. I believe it was a 2-2 pitch that Chad Bettis threw, and it was a called strike three, and Cervelli was kind of looking and everything. Or no, it was a 2-1 pitch. Because you will see that catchers usually don't complain about balls and strikes because they want to get that call too. And usually what'll happen.
Oh, yeah, they have to live back there. They have to put up with it themselves. And
they'll ask, you know, was that pitch low? Was that the bottom of the strike zone? You know, something like that. They'll ask something, you know, just to try to find out exactly where this guy's zone's going to be that day. And you could tell when he looked at him and goes, no way. Are you kidding me? That I thought maybe he just missed one. But then when Cargo got rung up, or not Cargo, Story got rung up, and Story's a rookie, so he's not going to say anything, but when Story got rung up in the bottom of the inning, and then Nolan got rung up the next inning, and it just kept going. I was like, this is not good. This is not good at all. And then in the fourth inning, Walt Weiss, he went out. And when Nick Hundley, when you have these calm manner guys like Nick Hundley, DJ LeMahieu, and I'm just using Rockies, Matt Carpenter's one of them. You know, when you have these calm manner guys, not these high strung guys like Bryce Harper and Matt Kemp and place and people like that, that are like really fired up and arguing, you know something is wrong.
Sure, absolutely.
And when Nick Hundley, a guy who ultimately respects, he's one of the good guys in the game, and he's a catcher, and he has to be back there, and he's arguing, not just going, what the heck is going on? He's arguing what's going on, and Walt Weiss has to come out and get him, and then Walt Weiss is walking away, and Weiss gets tossed. You know it's going to be a bad day.
Sure.
And then Wyatt Rayburn was almost to the top steps of the dugout, and he gets tossed. And it's like, are you kidding me? So you will get games every once in a while where the umpires are the show.
Well, take note of that. Write that umpire's name down, and when he comes back around in some other game somewhere, there are websites that'll show you who the umpire crew is, and when that guy lands behind the plate again, maybe you don't roster hitters from that game.
Yeah. I mean, there are there's umpire data out there, and
I know Fantasy Labs gives you some sort of an umpire adjustment almost to their numbers and to their rating system based on who's going to have a tighter strike zone or whatever. And, yep. And it's a minor factor, but they do it.
Yeah, and we're going to get into those are some advanced strategies that we're going to get into later on. You know, as we start progressing. So
it's important to tell people that are listening why you're so fired up about this, because if somebody's listening and isn't paying attention to baseball, this is their first year, they're learning this thing. Put yourself in the hitter's position. You've been playing baseball since you were six. And, you know, you're trying to learn, train your batter's eye, and it doesn't get easier as you get up there and the speed picks up and the movement picks up and all that stuff. And you know what you know about what a strike is. And you've got a guy like a Matt Carpenter, like you mentioned, Joey Votto, somebody who knows the strikes and who draws a lot of walks. Barry Bonds used to be that way. I'm telling you right now, if Joey Votto gets thrown out of a game arguing balls and strikes, the umpire was wrong. Because Joey Votto's eye is one of the best in the entire league, and he did a mild-tempered guy. He can brush off a lot, but when he gets pissed off, it's been inconsistent all night long. Because just because he thought that ball was a little off the plate and it got called a strike, he's cool. He'll come back in the next at-bat, and he'll be looking for that ball off the outside part of the plate, and he'll remember, well, that was a strike the last time, so I better swing at it this time. He makes that adjustment. When he gets pissed the second time, it's because now the inside one got called a strike, and that wasn't a strike in the previous at-bat. So as somebody listening to the game right now, or listening, trying to learn baseball right now, it's important to understand what those indicate, what those temper fits indicate. It isn't just a hothead going off. In a lot of cases, it is somebody with a trained eye, and I'm not talking about some Joe Schmo, you know, whatever hitter that just is just a total schlep. I'm talking about your good guys with a high walk total that have a known eye for the batter's on. When those guys get pissed, something's up.
Yeah, and, you know, Fantasy Alarm has a good umpire data report. I know Switch Analytics has one. Fantasy Labs has one that'll actually show you whether they favor the hitters or the pitchers and exactly by how much and stuff like that. There's a lot of good umpire data out there. It's not the end-all, be-all, but it is something that as we get going in MLB and we start to get more statistics as far as what a guy's – because just like players – umpires make adjustments over the course of the offseason too. Sure. They get graded just as well.
Accountability is up for debate.
Yeah, the accountability is up for debate because the quote unquote fines that they get or whatever, or the grades that they get, they're not public. The only time that it becomes public is if they're suspended or pulled off from games or stuff like that. And I think there needs to be more, there needs to be more referee accountability in all sports, from college and pro. and it needs to be made public. If we're going to make such a big deal out of a guy getting suspended for, you know, five games for whatever reason in NBA or, you know, MLB, then we need to make it known that, hey, look, if an umpire has a bad game, he's going to get demoted. He's not going to be able to do a plate rotation he's got to sit out a series for his rotation or, you know, whatever. He's going to get punished for having a bad game, just like just like anything else.
Right.
So
I'm with you. We could rant on that all day long.
Oh, yeah. So, anyways, FanDuel has started. Today's a new day to their updated scoring, I guess is what you would call it, whatever you want to call it. It's, in my opinion, it's a Band-Aid. I don't think that it is the savior. It is going to help a little bit as far as especially your 50-50s. I think this is where it's going to help at the top of your boards in the tournaments anyways. But their new scoring, runs and RBIs were both 3. Now they're going, runs are going up to 3.2. RBIs are going up to 3.5. That's going to help out a lot. You need to pay attention to this because I think the big place it's going to have an impact on is it's going to make 50-50s a little bit easier. And your double ups, your cash games, because now, there's a less likely chance that you are going to tie with somebody.
Right.
And I've seen 50-50s where the top, out of 100 man 50-50, the top, you know, there have been 35 people that have had the same score. And then you're talking about, okay, well, now I've only got a 15-team, you know, a 15-team gap where I have to get in there. But those 35 people don't have the same teams. It's not like they're buying lineups and running trains. They're different teams.
Right.
But they're all ended up on the same score.
We know that I'm a cash game guy. That's what I look to do first. That's the basis of the whole pyramid ladder structure that we talked about on Monday. My ROI has suffered because of the non-negative scoring. I have been caught on the cash line multiple times, and that's my fault for not, you know, getting that one extra hit or not picking the exact right player. I get that. I'll actually own some of that. I shouldn't be sitting on the cash line as frequently as I have been this year. I should be above it and comfortable. But when I'm on the cash line, in a 100-man 50-50, and there are 20 of us sitting on that cash line, that sucks. Because say I put my $5 in and I'm going to get back my $4. I'm not getting back $4. I'm getting back like $2.10. And that actually, yes, I cashed, but it actually cost me money and affected my ROI negative. It pisses me off.
I tied the other day in a quintuple up chop, a $5 quintuple up, okay? And
should have got 25.
Should have got 25. I got $3.99.
I had one. I cashed somewhere else. It was I don't know what it was. $5 league. Something got back like 75 cents or some crap. I was like, this is bullshit.
Yep. So that's going to help out a lot.
I'm glad
it's also
going to
help
it.
Out. Yes, I'm glad
at
they are addressing it.
A little.
I was scared. I was scared that they were, you know, with everything that's going on as far as legal battles and stuff like that, I was really honestly scared that they weren't going to be able to, that they were going to be afraid to do that because they didn't want to get into somebody saying, oh, well, they're changing scoring and making it to where it's more advantageous, because you know somebody is going to say that if they haven't already. And
you know the old adage, though. The old adage is follow the dollar. And honestly, FanDuel doesn't make this change if they weren't getting a ton of complaints about the negative scoring or the ties or the whatever, because they're realizing this is going to dip into their pockets. And so they made a slight change and a slight adjustment to retain customers ultimately. That's all it was.
And I've noticed that. And some of it has to do with New York, and some of it has to do with Texas and stuff like that. But the tournaments are not as big as they were last year. And I know, yeah, it's a changing landscape because of those two states and stuff like that.
It has a lot to do with legality. It really does.
But I also think that some of it is the fact that when they changed this, people started playing more at other sites.
It could be. We don't have access to that information. If we did, we wouldn't be sitting here doing this podcast this morning. But,
but we wouldn't be allowed to play on the sites either, so it wouldn't really matter.
That's you, my job.
If we had access to that information, we wouldn't be allowed to play.
We don't need to bring that up again.
I think the big thing that you're going to have to look for now is it's going to put let me pull up the article real quick because I had a great. I was reading a lot of stuff about it last night. Not that it changed. It's going to change my approach too much. You're still going to target players and stuff like this.
It's not going to change my approach really at all because 3.5 versus 3.2, we're talking about a third of a point, and it's going to take a while for that little bitty advantage to bear out over time. I'm not going to all of a sudden start rostering guys who, you know, hit RBIs. The fifth place batter did not all of a sudden become more valuable than the first place batter, all other things considered equal. It's one of those situations where it will help break up the scoring a little bit, and it might be the eighth or ninth tiebreaker that I look at, but I'm pretty much just going to put my head down and try to roster guys that score runs and drive in runs. You know, everything is who I'm still focused on. It's not going to change a whole lot about what I do.
Yeah, Fantasy Labs had a great, they've got graphs, and for those of you that are in Slack, I'm posting them in, Keith only posts here, and it's by RBIs and by runs for batting spots in the order, and it's actually kind of funny because if you want to go, as far as run or RBIs, I would rather now roster a six-hole hitter rather than a one-hole hitter if I'm looking for RBIs. But you can break this down, and you can see that as far as RBIs, your big three spots are your 3, 4, 5 guys, which is something that we already knew. But what is interesting to me is that, you know, if you've got a one- and two-hole hitter, as far as the same price at the same position, I'm more likely now to roster a two-hole hitter because they score just as many runs. Now, it's all going to be depending on who the player is and stuff like that.
Sure, there's always other factors.
Yeah, but as far as
you're looking in a percentage, vacuum, dead apples to
percentage,
apples.
Exactly, percentage of MLB RBIs according to the batting order spot, the number two-hole has or drives in 11% of the runs compared to 10% at the one hole, but they both score 14% of the runs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you start to take those numbers and you start to apply it, and you won't always see it exactly, you know, right off the bat, but if you start applying these things over the long haul, then it will start to make a difference. You will start to see your scores go up and stuff like that. So
here's my opinion. Now, as a DFS mind grows into baseball, as you learn the sport more, you're going to start realizing that, yes, a leadoff hitter scores runs. Yes, a six hitter scores, you know, really attaches his value to a little bit of RBI situations because he's got all those guys ahead of him getting on base. But really and truly, what are you going to – a leadoff hitter might score, I mean, in a good game, three runs. A six hitter can get three RBIs in one swing of the bat. Now, yeah, he's going to end up with 80 RBIs for the season, and the leadoff hitter is going to end up with 60 RBIs for the season, and, you know, whatever else. But over the grand scheme of a season, it might not make a whole lot of difference between the RBIs and the runs that each position, you know, scores when you add up the RBIs and the runs together for each spot. But where it is going to make a dramatic effect when you're talking about a leadoff hitter versus a six or five spot hitter now, is in daily fantasy. Where in daily fantasy, I'm going to have a four RBI game out of my six hole hitter more often than I'm going to have a four run scoring game out of my leadoff hitter.
Yeah.
So when I'm looking at that, I'm looking for opportunity. I'm looking for who am I going to roster. Now, I want the one spot because, and this is something I don't have the ability in my little pea-brained head to process the math, but I want to know where it offsets how many more times the one-hole guy comes up to the plate. How many more in the non-negative era, how many more at-bats is he going to generate? Now, again, over the course of a year, it's a lot. Over the course of a day, it might not be that much. So the extra weight to the RBI and the fact that in one at-bat I can get three RBIs as opposed to just score one run, maybe there is something to that. Maybe we do shift our thought, and instead of just strictly going 1-4 or 1-5, maybe we start getting into that six-hole hitter a little bit.
Yeah, it's I don't mind rostering, especially in these offensives that produce a lot of points. I don't mind at all rostering six or produce a lot of points.
And you're also looking for prices, because if the leadoff hitter is a $4,000 guy and the six-hole hitter is a $2,200 guy, guess where I'm looking.
Well, I know one thing's for sure. I'm not looking for the Braves for power. Do you want to know how many – take a wild guess how many home runs they have this year as a team.
I already know the answer. And I can tell you that there are five St. Louis Cardinals that have more than the Atlanta Braves do as a team. Five Cardinals individually have more home runs than the Atlanta Braves do as a team. Your number is three.
Yeah.
How about that for a little show prep, baby?
Wow.
I was actually just listening to the broadcast last night being a Cardinals fan, because they were running down how many Cardinals have more than three home runs. And they said, do you realize it? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to use that someday. So thank you for leading me right into that one.
I saw it come across on Twitter. And
yeah, it's a pretty mind blowing stat. It's pretty mind blowing.
I was like, no way, that can't be right. And they have
numbers
three.
Don't lie, man. Numbers don't lie.
Numbers never lie. They'll just tell you, they'll just lead you on and tease you a little bit.
It's scary. If I was an Atlanta Braves fan right now, I wouldn't be disheartened, because, you know, you had your run. And to be honest with you, that's why I don't feel too bad as a St. Louis Cardinals fan watching these Cubbies. I actually kind of like the Cubbies. I'm one of the weird St. Louis people that can kind of go both ways. I love my Cardinals, don't get me wrong. But if this is kind of the end of this 15-year unprecedented run we've had for our franchise, I'm okay with it as long as we rebuild and get back to it. Atlanta's rebuilding, retooling, a lot of young guys. They're I don't have any problem with it, but I'm telling you what, three
we're
home runs.
We're not going to make a playoff.
I didn't say that.
You beat us in
Shut it.
I didn't say that. That's not my style. I'm just saying that I'm not going to be the guy that goes down bitching, complaining, crying, moaning about how we need to be good every year, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, right. You I'm and not. Every other Cardinals fan is the exact same.
Don't.
That if you don't make the playoffs this year, or the Cubs are a sustained better team than you guys are, that you're going to burn down the damn city.
Don't lump me into that group. I'm not that guy.
Whatever. We'll see. We'll see come September and October.
No, I'll express my disappointment. I'll say, what a bummer. But I won't cry and whine and act like, you know, the Cubs did it unjustifiably and that they got lucky. That's not my deal. I'll tip my hat. Absolutely. I saw them coming last year, man. It was just like Cardinals are in for it now. They finally got a division rival that means something. I look forward to the fact that these cities are going to go back and forth. And
finally, you guys have had the Pirates for the last 2 years.
I'm talking about with the Cubs, which is the traditional close proximity rivalry. Yeah, the Pirates have been there for you. The Reds were there for a while. The Brewers had a few good years where they all threatened the Cardinals. And I'm not saying this as the prima donna Cardinal fan that always came out on top. I'm saying that it is nice to have the Cubs get into it, because the one rivalry that goes back and forth over beers across a table with this city. I wanted the Brewers to become that rivalry. It didn't materialize. I wanted the Reds to become that rivalry. I don't mind the Pirates being that rivalry, but the Cubs goes back 100 years. And in St. Louis, there's a lot of people that live just on the Illinois side of the river that work over here, and it's just a lot more localized and a lot more fun. So I'm excited for it.
Okay.
Knocked that train off the tracks now, didn't we?
Yeah, sorry. I'm watching the replay of Andrew McCutchen's three bombs.
Yeah, dude, what the hell?
Okay, let me throw this out here, because everybody's like, oh, dude, it was below the Mendoza line before last night.
Jeez. Go ahead, roster him up in cash. You've got all the indicator. All the arrows are pointing up.
All the arrows are pointing. Okay, and this is something that we're going to get into, and this is a nice little segue, okay? And we will get into it definitely here in just a second, but we're going to go over cash game lineup building strategy, okay? And I think this is important to have Chop on because he is going to – I'm not the best daily fantasy player in the world, and I don't claim to be, but I am very, very good, and I'm not afraid to take on anybody, especially anybody with one lineup. You start getting these other guys in there that do mega multi-entries and stuff like that, and yeah, they're profitable, and congrats to them, but I've seen it at live finals, and I have a – everybody knows I'm a Q whore, and I watch these live finals as far as the actual finals that I'm not in. I watch the scoreboards and stuff, and I see, you know, players having multiple lineups in there. And I can tell you that there are players that have had multiple lineups in every live final that I've watched the last 2 years that have only finished in the top three once or twice, and it's one of those things, like, they're great when they can set 50, 60, 80, 100 lineups, but when it comes down to making those decisions on one, that doesn't mean that they're a good fantasy player. They just know how to work it. They know how to diversify their portfolio.
You don't have to be Warren Buffett of the DFS world to do well here. You need to – that's why I rant and rave so often about betting allocation and contest selection, because you have to absolutely know how many shares of which players you have, where you're putting them, and it's the overall portfolio that generates your ROI. And it's – yes, it's one contest that does it, and it bails out a lot of other contests. But if the overall core of your lineup – we talk about that in NFL all the time. You pick a core and you spin secondaries off of your core. If you can get that part of DFS down, you're going to be formidable. You're going to be good.
Yeah, it's and that's the thing. There's a lot of different ways to be profitable in this space. And I don't fault anybody. I don't fault anybody for knowing what their strengths are and what type of the player they are, and you know, going out and running with it. He's 25 by 11 days, MLB. Oh my gosh. MLB Central had this best three-hole hitters 24 or younger. And I was like, wait, why is Nolan not on that list? And that's because he's 25 and 11 days. Whatever. They made him like the 20th ranked player in MLB and like the fifth best third baseman overall or something, or he was outside the top 10 or something like that. I don't know what it was, and it was a joke. Because in my mind, he's a top 10 player in baseball right now, and he's the best third baseman, both offensively and defensively in the game. So, and say what you want about Coors Field, but his power translates outside of Coors Field as well.
Yes,
his average jumps at Coors, but power is power is power, and that's one thing that we're about to get into. Okay, so let's get into cash game lineup building and what we kind of look for. We're going to break it down position by position and some of the key things that we look for when we're rostering these players. And let's start it out at the top. Pitcher for FanDuel. You need one pitcher. The win is 12 points. It is vitally important. We know how big of an impact that strikeouts are. So in my mind, for cash games, it's pretty simple. You take the guy that has the Vegas line that has the best chance to win, that's the biggest favorite, and that has and hopefully he has the a very, very good K per nine number or K percentage number, as we'll get into as we go into advanced analytics and statistics that we're gonna start teaching you guys on. And if those things add up, and he's got a good offense behind it, then we have Jake Arrieta as a minus 3 freaking 58 favorite today against the Cubs or the Brewers.
Yeah. As a cash game guy that's going to run 50-50s and head-to-heads, I'm going to tell you Arrieta is the new Kershaw. If you listen to Fantasy Insiders as other podcasts and whatever else, you hear this rule around DFS now all the time that says if you don't roster Kershaw in cash, you're doing it wrong. And while yesterday we had other options, and I disagree with that philosophy as a whole, I am just about ready to take Arrieta and substitute him in for Kershaw's name. Arrieta is on a run right now that is really hitting some rarefied air. He is almost that way. If you don't roster him in cash, you're doing it wrong.
I had somebody try to compare him to Russell Westbrook without Kevin Durant.
Yeah, that somebody was me. I did.
I think you're 100% dead wrong in that part. In that comparison, I think you're wrong. Because, in my opinion, there are times where it's not going to warrant paying for Jake Arrieta in cash. And
if he lands on the same slate as Kershaw and Scherzer, or he lands on the same slate as
those are two not good examples now.
No, they might not be, but they're elite pitchers the same. And if one of them is $2,000 underneath, you know, Arrieta and Kershaw, yeah, the guy warrants consideration. But you're not going to be wrong by just slapping Arrieta in there.
Yep, I agree with you 100%. It's one of those things that. To me, a cash game pitcher would have to check off three boxes. Does he have a high K percentage? He's got to have a top 5 K percentage of the day. And I don't care, you know, what it really is. I mean, as far as it's got to be on the sliding scale. You know, he's got to have the top 5K percentage of the day. And, you know, it's kind of funny because Jake Arrieta today does not check that box. But he's right outside. He's number 6, you know. So that you got to kind of take it into consideration. He's got to be a heavy favorite, meaning that 3 out of 4 times – his team with him pitching is probably going to win the game, and Jake Arrieta checks that box. And 2 or 3, he's got to be able to work deep into ball games, you know. And the fourth one is he's got to have an offense behind him. He's got to have an offense that is going to be able to score runs, because if he goes, you know, 7 innings and his offense more times than he doesn't receive any run support, your win percentage is going down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a huge, huge, huge swing as far as 12 points.
That's where people are going to miss that. That money line of minus 340 is not that Arrieta is going to get the win. It's that the Cubs are going to win the game.
Yes. So
that's a big thing. That's a big thing to understand.
And that's one of the things that, you know, as we get deeper into ball games, we get more of a sample size for these pitchers. You know, you've got to look at what is the guy's average start? The best way to see if you want to know if a guy is giving his team a chance to win his starts, there's a statistic that I think is absolutely great for this, even though I hate it overall because I think it's a joke. It's quality starts. Go look at quality starts. How many quality starts does this guy have? You know, if he's got 15 games that he's started and he's only got like 3 or 4 quality starts, obviously that's a tournament play. But if he's got 15 games started, he's got, you know, 11, 12 quality starts, because everybody can have a bad game, you know, then he's giving his team a chance to win. Because a quality start is he's working at least 6 innings and allowing 3 or less runs while he's in the game.
He's controlling the factors he can control.
Exactly.
He can't control if his offense doesn't show up that night, but as long as he kept the other team off the board, and in DFS purposes, you know, fanned a few as he did it, then he's doing his job.
Yep, and we were talking about Shelby Miller before the game or before the show. And do you realize Shelby Miller, he had, I think at one point last year, it was a 2.78 or something ERA like
Absolutely.
That. It was below three. And he hadn't won a freaking game.
No, yeah, absolutely. He got off
His run support was horrible.
He got off to a hell of a good start last year. He was striking out, you know, numbers that were above and beyond his career pace as well. If I'm looking at a guy, I'm going to try and cut my pitchers down for cash games. The ultimate thing for cash games that you hear is don't take any risk. Don't take any risk. So I'm looking for safe pitchers. Safe pitchers are going to have Vegas on their side. They're going to have high strikeout numbers. You can look at K percentage. You can look at K per nine and look for a number over nine. You can look at K per inning and look for a number over one. Whatever number you look at, that you're looking for somebody that's going to throw a lot of strikeouts. Then you can translate into what I do oftentimes is look at who they're facing and how often that other team strikes out. And we can get into debating right-handed, left-handed, all that stuff. I use a very generic number, and I need to get more specific with it. But I just look at, you know, what team is typically striking out a lot. Now, I've learned to get away from that because specifically my Cardinals strike out against left-handed pitching a lot more than right-handed pitching. So there's a lot of value into those splits. But I look for those three factors first. Then I do look at innings pitched. I look at the ballpark that the guy is in. I'll roster a guy as a tiebreaker in – you know, San Diego, L.A., San Francisco, somewhere like that, over rostering a guy in Cincinnati or Milwaukee or Houston for obvious reasons. But once those guys start checking those boxes, and another big indicator is their salary on FanDuel or DraftKings, the higher-priced guys are generally your safer guys. That's why they tell you to pay up for pitching. I don't have to take that unnecessary gamble and roster some $8,000 pitcher and then have to go after my bats that may fail on me by going 0 for 4. I'm controlling as much production in my lineup as I possibly can. And for pitchers, those are the guys that are going to accumulate more points per player most times. That's why they cost more. They're more consistent. That's who you look for first in building a cash roster, in my opinion.
Yeah, they're more predictable. Pitching is a lot easier to predict than hitting, even though we'll get into that.
See, and you may not like this analogy either, but it's like the quarterback in football. Why are his stats more consistent across time? Because he touches the ball more often. Pitcher touches the ball more often.
Oh, yeah.
He controls the game more. He controls his own production more.
Yeah, I mean, you just think about this. A starting pitcher is going to throw 100 pitches or so, you know, where a hitter is going to, in the course of a game, see if he's a high-level elite hitter that, you know, gets four at-bats, he might see 20 pitches a game.
Okay, yeah.
You know? And that's spread.
Who's got more chances to affect the outcome of the game?
Exactly.
And
exactly. Now, in my opinion, who affects the game more? It's 100% the
Andrew McCutchen, apparently.
Shut! Oh my!
You go hit Albert Pujols, Mark McGwire, whoever you want to go back to. You start ripping three dongs a night, you're going to affect the hell out of your lineup. You know, I can't. But those are obviously very, very rare. Jake Arrieta is going to hit 60 points a lot more often than Andrew McCutchen is. You know, that fact's undisputable.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, all right. So, catcher. This is kind of a hot button topic because this is where I've got to start being able to adjust mindsets and look at two different ways to kind of think about it. Obviously, my big thing is you know, when people zig, I zag, and when people jump, I, you know, jump higher, faster, farther, whatever, however you want to look at it. What do you like to do on catcher?
It's my favorite position to punt.
Okay.
And
what are you looking for as far as
the cheapest guy that does not suck? I mean, I'm being serious. And if you read a lot, if you read articles by cash game players, guys that, and again, I think it's easier for a brand new guy to learn cash first and then start diving into the other stuff, because it's going to teach you kind of the value of what you're looking at when you're looking for things. Catcher is a position that is fairly scarce as far as middle of the order guys. It is fairly scarce as far as high priced guys. It is fairly scarce as far as, you know, massive contributors to their team and to their lineup. There are Buster Posey's out there, but most catchers across a given slate are crapshoots. There's maybe three or four good ones, and a lot of cases are crapshoots. So if that's the case, and I'm not going to pay up for Buster Posey, which is a fine play most nights when he's going well especially, but if I'm not going to, because I view that money being more valuable somewhere else in my lineup, in a spot that traditionally produces a little bit more, I don't need to get off the herd by punting first base and rostering a high-priced catcher, because that'll certainly get me off the herd. I'm only looking for how to build the best lineup, and for me, if I look at my catcher, I see 8 or 10 choices below $2,600, $2,700, and 3 choices above $3,000. I'm not necessarily looking to punt, but if I see guys down that cheap that are hitting fifth, sixth in the order and are facing a mediocre pitcher, I'm looking to punt.
Yeah, I generally...
But I want an ISO with that guy. ISO is the isolated power number, and I want a guy that can hit the ball out of the park when he does run into one. I don't want Yadier Molina necessarily. He's hitting for average, but he's not hitting a lot of doubles. He's, I guess he kind of is early, but he's not hitting home runs, and he does not have the strength anymore to do it. So Yadier Molina typically is a little oppo slappo type of guy, and that's fine for getting you some cash game points, but it takes more than 3 to 6 to 9 points out of your catcher spot these days. You got to get the Saltamacchias, you got Saltalamacchias, you got to get, you know, run into a Yan Gomes or a Chris Iannetto or a Wellington Castillo one of these days to get that 18 points in one big swing.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up his name, because I was about to hit it. There are two statistics that I'm gonna point out here. I look at WOBA.
Yes.
WOBA versus handedness of pitcher, and if you don't know what that is, it's weighted on base average, and it takes into a bunch of different things. That is extremely important when it comes to daily fantasy, in my opinion.
It might be the most important stat top to bottom.
Yes. Overall, I think for hitters and pitchers alike it is. Now, one of the things that I will say is it's not the end-all, be-all. No. I also look at weighted runs created plus.
Okay.
And the reason for that is I want to know that my guy is able to help his team win. And there are a lot of different ways that you can do that. And basically what runs created plus is you've got a baseline of league average of 100. Okay. So when you think of league average right now, on tonight's slate, and we're doing this at the end part of April, you're talking about, as of right now, Chris Coughlin is league average as far
as weighted
runs. Yeah, well, I'm just saying, as to give you a player, a player view of what it is. Brian McCann, Francisco Cervelli. Let's see here. I know there's going to be some other ones. I'm just kind of going through real quick. Wilson Ramos.
These are all guys that are about league average.
These are all guys above the league average.
For is this positional? WRC plus is league wide, right?
Yes, this is league wide. But I was just saying, like, Chris Coughlin is at a 100. Okay, these are all catchers that are above him, so you kind of know what to look for. Like I said, Francisco Cervelli, Brian McCann. You know, if you go up a little bit farther, you've got Stephen Vogt or Vogt. Yep. That's a good one. He hits in the middle of that order.
He's still cheap.
Wilson Ramos. And these are guys that are extremely important to their – Victor Martinez is up there.
It's not a coincidence these guys are hitting in the middle of their orders or above the seven spot.
Right. You know, and that's generally what you can look for and you can hit. And it's great to be able to put these guys that are cheap in the top of your lineups.
So because you can find value there, because a lot of these catchers can pop one over the wall, I mean, that I think is a really, really weird thing. If you look at how many catchers hit home runs in a given night in DFS, you'll almost always find a couple. So it kind of pushes me towards a guy that has some power potential. If I can find a guy with an above average, above 100 WRC plus, if I can find a guy who's got above a 350 WOBA, if I can find a guy who's got a above 950 OPS, whatever metric you want to use is fine. And again, he's in a good matchup because he's facing mediocre pitching, preferably in a decent ballpark, and he hits somewhere in the middle of his order, and he's cheap. There's going to be four or five of those per slate. That's why I punt catcher so often.
Yeah, and I'm not even really necessarily looking for power. Power is just the plus part of it. Now, if there's two guys that have generally the same, you know, I'll use for that, for catcher, since I'm punting it, I'll use that as the tiebreaker. I'll use the ISO as the tiebreaker on that because, you know, I don't need, if I'm punting it, I'm punting it to be able to get my power at other spots. So I don't typically need to have, you know, power at that position. If they've got a outstanding WOBA and they've got a good...
I think you'd be looking at OBP in that position, what catchers are getting on base. If you're just looking for 3 to 6 to 9 points out of a catcher, what do you just need a guy getting on base.
That's taken into account and weighted on base.
I understand this, but...
You know, because I'll give you an idea. Gerald Saltzman-Lamacchia has a 381 OBP. He's got a 476 WOBA against right-handed bats this year with a 222 runs created plus.
Okay.
His ISO is at a 500. His OPS is at a 1.159.
Well, but this is what I was getting at in my suggestion. If you just want a guy in the heart of an order, it's helping his team and getting on base and whatever else because you're punting catcher and you just want something out of the guy, then you can look straight at OBP and see who's getting on base a lot. But when you look at the WOBA, it tells you who's getting on base and doing something with it, so it at least hedges you towards some upside and tells you that the guy is being productive with his at-bats. He's not just drawing walks. He's not just doing nothing. He's actually hitting some doubles. He's hitting some home runs.
Yeah, and weighted runs created plus, basically, it's going to take into account ballpark factors and stuff like that. And it's basically telling you how many runs this guy helps create. Okay? And like we said, league average is 100, and the higher above 100, obviously, you know, that's where you get your Josh Donaldsons, your Dexter Fowlers, your Bryce Harpers, your, you know, Ryan Braun's, Corey Dickerson, Nolan Arenado. I mean, these are all guys that are above a 175 weighted runs created plus on the season so far. And these are huge, huge, huge things that you have to look for that, you know, you can start to see things that other players aren't seeing. And where that's not as important in cash games, it's extremely important to you because in cash games, you're not looking to win the day. You're looking to win and profit over the course of the season, over the course of a week, over the course of a series. So if you are confident in the numbers and you make constantly and you consistently are making good decisions, then you are going to consistently profit. So that's where these numbers start to, you know, really, really, really pay a dividend for. So so you like to punt catcher.
Yes.
Let's go to first base because I've had some discussions on this one, and I believe I am of a different mindset of you. What do you look for at first base?
I'm of the belief from watching some you know, Jonathan Bales type stuff and whatever else and seeing some of his graphics that first base is the most productive spot as far as fantasy production. That means that the majority of players of the in the player pool are a larger factor in their lineups, so I'm more inclined to pay up in that category.
Okay. I was going more for power or...
That's what you're
going to
get. When you pay up, that's what you're going to get. You got a lot of boppers at first base. I mean, it's why they're there. They don't play defense. You know, they're not in the game to effect. A good defensive first baseman is just a nice icing on the cake to a baseball team. They'd rather the guy jack two out every night because he doesn't need to move around that much. He doesn't need to throw that much. He doesn't need to have a lot of those skill sets as long as he can swing the lumber. So that's why they end up there, which is why that spot produces more, which is why we typically pay up for it, because that's where you find your one-swing power shots, your massive point producers that, you know, and I would obviously like a steady Eddie there, you know, like a Joey Votto type or whatever, but I don't mind rostering Chris Davis there either because the guy's going to hit 50 out a year, and I'm going to just naturally run into a few of them by keeping going on back to the well when he's in good matchups.
Yeah, that's something that's huge. This is where I tend to pay more attention to. I want a guy that is safer, but has huge upside. And you know, everybody's floor in baseball is zero. But when you start looking at cash games, you know, you can start to go through and look and okay. Even if he doesn't get a hit, or if he doesn't he doesn't hit a dong, or you know anything like that, how productive is he otherwise? Does he score runs? Does he get RBIs? Usually, your first baseman, unless your name is John Jaso, you're a high RBI guy. Mm-hmm. You know, does he walk a lot? Joey Votto, when he's on, is my favorite go-to.
Oh, absolutely. He's got triple dong power too, to be honest with you. He's got the ability. He's got double dong, legit double dong potential.
But
any night.
He's also one of the most frustrating
mm-hmm.
people to watch, because what you're sitting there doing is he will take a walk instead of trying to drive a ball to the outfield and score a run on a sacrifice fly.
Cincinnati's been on his ass for years about it, trying to get him to swing bat a little bit more and actually take a shot at driving that run in from first, and he says, hell no, my job's to get on base and not make it out. That's how I help this team more. And while I get that, I will still say, as far as just a cash game safe play, now he can't be in a slump, but he's the premier cash game first baseman because he carries some decent power numbers, but he carries a very high wOBA most times. He needs some surrounding help, but he's going to put together a 40-game hit streak way more often than, you know, Chris Davis is.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, or even an Edwin Encarnacion or, you know, Jose Abreu, whatever, some of these other names that you can think of. The guy, he gets on base. He runs streaks together. Every single night you can count on Joey Votto getting on base.
Yeah. And
I'll tell you a number to look for cash game stuff. This might be a good time to bring it up. Is if you can find a site that does fantasy points per game or fantasy points per at bat. Those guys that are high, you're going to have your guys, if he hits like two or three dongs in a week, he's going to have a high number for that week. But look for a guy across the season that does it. And I've never looked into it myself. That's why I'm bringing it up. But you want a guy that's going to stretch out over the course of a month or over the course of 2 months.
Well, you know how easy that is. It's just take your total number of fantasy points divided by at bat.
Who wants to do the work, though? I'd rather a site do it.
You got to do it by plate appearance, really, because a walk doesn't count.
And that's fine, but I'd like to see if a guy like a Chris Davis who hits a lot of home runs, and I'm just looking at the two side-by-side on my screen, which is why I keep going back to the same names. But if I look at a guy like a Chris Davis who hits 50 home runs in a year and a Joey Votto who draws a lot of walks, hits a lot, you know, knocks a lot of guys in, hits a lot of doubles, hits some home runs too, but isn't ever going to hit 50 in a year, I want to know who, per plate appearance, who has the highest fantasy production, because I have a lot better chance at, say it's a 1.5 per at-bat, or per plate appearance. He gets 5 plate appearances a night, 6 points. And Chris Davis, maybe, because he's a little bit more boom or bust, maybe has a 4 points per plate appearance. Or, you know, in a game, 1 point per plate appearance would be the number. Then that would indicate to me that Votto's a better cash play because I'm going to get more points out of him more often. He's going to have a higher floor, which is what we're looking for.
Yeah, I think overall, as far as hitters, I want safety and upside. And, you know, there's times where, like, I love rostering Chris Davis.
So do I. He hits home runs so frequently, he's almost got a floor.
Hey, exactly. But, you know, and I've made this argument before. If you could play pretty much the same lineup, if you could draft a lineup, you know, every day in cash games, and just rotate your starting pitcher, you know, as long as you're, you know, maybe one or two players and stuff like that, but try to, you know, do it for a week. Do it for 7 days, or
let's say
I don't recommend you play 7 days in a row. I think that's just ludicrous, especially in a daily sport. You know, do it Monday through Friday.
Do it for a series.
And, yeah, or
a series, a couple days. The pricing typically changes as guys go into series and out of series. That's typical on FanDuel. They don't fluctuate as much day to day as DraftKings does. We've made mention of that. So for me, let's say that a guy like a John Jaso or a, what's his name, Francisco Cervelli or whatever, is rolling into Coors, and you look at the pitching and it's not going to be any left-handed guy that they don't, and I'm not looking at it in front of me, so forgive me. I'm trying to think as generically as I can. But if I have a guy who doesn't do well against left-handed hitting and he's going to face three righties at Coors, why the hell, if he gets a zero the first night, would I get off of him the next night? If he's not facing an ace all of a sudden, I mean, there's that too. But if he's facing three mediocre pitchers in a good spot three nights in a row and his price isn't going to change, why am I looking anywhere else tomorrow night just because the guy got me a zero? He's going to get some points for you in those three games, and you have to have him to do it.
The only way I would say getting off of somebody like that, getting off of anybody that's in Coors, is if they are just not seeing the ball well over their last five
to seven
games.
Okay, so maybe Coors was not a great example. It was an example of a great ballpark.
Right. No.
It's called chasing your tail.
That's something that we want to talk about because, you know, we talked about this conversation last night and we were going through and we were like, okay, well, you know, what makes – we were talking about Christian Adames last night. $2,500, he scored you 12-something. I think it was like 12 points, okay? He was $2,500 in starting at shortstop and batting second. He was an automatic. He should have been 100% owned in cash games, in my opinion. Because in Coors, he still has a propensity to hit a dong.
Yeah.
Now, and we were talking about this. Christian Adames did not lose the starting shortstop position for the Colorado Rockies in spring training. He and every other season he would have won it. Trevor Story took it and ran. Okay, Christian Adames is a very good shortstop. He's a very, very serviceable hitter. He's a good 2-hole or 7-hole, and it's kind of one of those things that it's just one of those things that is, you've got to look at this. When you get a guy, in my opinion, in Coors Field, unless he's not seeing the ball well over a larger sample size, 5 to 7 to 14 games, anybody over 3,000 or under 3,000 in Coors Field, I don't care what part of the lineup that they're in, they're going in my lineup. They're going into a lot of my lineups. And that might be a donkey move, but Coors Field automatically raises the floor of every hitter that goes in there.
Yeah. By the nature of them running into home runs every once in a while.
Yeah, and it's
and big cavernous outfield that the balls drop in, you know. Absolutely. And the fact that the pitchers have a little harder time controlling their breaking stuff out there, so the pitches are a little straighter. I mean, all of that stuff plays into the Coors effect that people talk about.
Yep. All right, let's go on to second base here. Second base, what are you looking for?
It's another punt position for me. I'm not saying total punt, but it's another one of those middle infield. So when you say shortstop, I'm going to say the same thing. Typically, my power spots I'm willing to pay up for because it's where I'm going to find the majority of guys in the middle infield and the catching, the middle, you know, the middle defensive spots are the guys that I'm looking for the cheaper value plays because I've just got a ton of them to choose from. When I've got a ton of them to choose from, I can play the matchups down low for price a little bit better, save my money for the guys that are more likely to produce the power elsewhere. I love Brian Dozier. Don't get me wrong. I love Jose Altuve. Don't get me wrong. But there's two or three or four guys, once again, and then there's another 10 guys that are down in there somewhere that do on a daily basis run into good ballparks, bad pitching, and all sorts of things that you can then take advantage of and then go roster your big boys.
Yep. I think for me, the first thing I look at for second base is the guy multidimensional? Can he hit for average or power? Can he get on base and run? Can he steal bases?
It's another good spot to mention top of the order guys.
Yes, I love second basemen that
not necessarily leading off, but top of the order guys, 1 through 4.
One through four. Typically you'll find your second baseman in 1-3.
Because you're going to find a second baseman in the 1 or 2 spot, or you're going to find him in the 8 or 9. You know, you're not often going to find him in the 3 like Correa, you know, or, you know, give me a second baseman that's up in the middle of the order somewhere. I just thought of Bogarts. I'm thinking, I'll tell you one. If you want a really good cash play for now that has been playing fairly well lately, which is also a factor, guys will play themselves in and out of cash consideration based on how consistent they've been over the past week or two, like you mentioned. Look at Oakland. Look at Jed Lowry. Guy's hitting in the 4-hole as a second baseman. He's a switch-hitting guy for $2,300. Is he the most talented guy in the world? No. Is he a superpower guy? Not really. But you know what? He's in the 4-hole, and he's going to get opportunity for $2,300, and that shores up a cheap second baseman. That is a punt and a production spot all wrapped into one. If he gets a mediocre pitcher like this, you know, today Justin Verlander's been struggling a little bit this year, you might run him out there if you're rostering a big price pitcher because it's a great spot to save money and still give yourself access to a lot of opportunity.
Yeah, I think Chase Utley is another good example. Starlin Castro, his price has gone up there now. But, I mean, there's a lot of good ones. Just kind of looking through it.
Odor's starting to heat up in Texas. He's pricey, but he's, you know, when I'm looking to talk about punting and stuff, I'm not looking to spend, you know, and it's not a true punt, but I'm not looking to spend, you know, $3,000 on a guy because I'm going to need, I want to spend $3,500 somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, when Howie Kendrick's numbers start to kind of turn around a little bit, right now he's the bare bone minimum, $2,000.
He's a good one.
Yeah, but he's got to start seeing the ball
absolutely
better.
And Dozier's a good one. Dozier's a great one. When Dozier starts getting hot, just roster him for the next week. Shut your eyes, throw him in there until his price gets up to $4K or something. Dustin Pedroia is another one. Dustin Pedroia is a great cash game second baseman. Just shut your eyes, throw him in there until he starts getting pricey. He's getting up into the mid-3Ks right now, so he becomes a little bit more matchup-based than usual, but when he's 2.8, 2.9, oh, dear Lord, just plug and play. He's in a great offense. He's in the top of the order. He can hit for a little bit of power. He gets multiple hits per game when he's seeing the ball well. He drives in some runs. I mean, what else are you looking for out of a $2,600, $2,700 guy?
Exactly. And I can't stress enough, they've got to be multidimensional, meaning if they take a walk, can they steal a base?
Are they scoring runs?
Are they in a premier RBI position in the batting order, or are they in a premier run scoring position in the batting order? Because if a guy gets on doing an error, you know, I don't want him to, you know, I want him to have a chance to, you know, score on a double in the gap, and get me some points, because we don't get points for the air anymore. Now, thankfully, we don't get negative points, which that should have never been a negative point, in my opinion. That and Fielder's Choices should have never been negative points, but we don't get negative points, but we don't get any points off of it, so I've got to be able to capitalize. Is he going to steal a base? Is he going to score runs because he's got good guys hitting behind him? So, all right, shortstop, what are you looking for?
Really and truly, those, I consider them identical, shortstop and second base. There's not anything different that I'm looking in one over the other. I didn't, in cash, and this, again, is going to sound foreign and stupid to a lot of people, but in a lot of cases, I did not roster Tulowitzki in cash games the past couple of years because, yes, he's an auto play. Yes, he's the greatest shortstop when healthy and hitting at Coors and mashing, left-handed pitching or whatever the hell we're talking about. It's a power spot, but he was also $5,000 in a lot of cases. And I'm not saying he was a terrible play. And a lot of the chalk went that direction when he played in Coors against that handedness of pitching. But I still look for the value guys first because I want something elsewhere. He's the only guy at that, and Trevor Story, if you could have hopped on that train, but he's the only guy at shortstop that, in my opinion, is typically worth paying up for. Those days are changing, though. We need a caveat in there because there are a lot of power-hitting shortstops now. We're going back to the old Garcia-Para days. But I'm talking 2-3 years ago, there were a lot more choices like catcher down low in the price pool that, I could run an Alcides Escobar out there in Kansas City, hitting at the top of the order, never got over $2,600, $2,700, and would not do what Tulowitzki did for me, but would, instead of handcuffing me and making me roster two $2,400 outfielders, I could roster two $3,000 outfielders.
Yeah, I think that one of the big things to do and to think of is, you've got to sit there and kind of look at position scarcity.
Yep.
And shortstop is usually one of the lightest positions on the slates. Depending on the matchups. And the biggest thing that I always take into account is, what does this guy bring to the table? If, like tonight, we've got Story in Coors, Correa in Seattle, and Seager in Los Angeles, and then Tulo in Toronto. Well, I mean, right now you've got Xander Bogaerts in Atlanta or in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Gene Segura has been killing it up, even though he should be a freaking short or second baseman.
If you have four or five options up there that are higher priced, that are all in great matchups, then yeah, you're not punting the position. You might in a GPP.
One of my biggest ones that I love...
In cash games, you're going to kind of get forced to go along with everybody in that spot.
Yeah, I love playing Alcides Escobar. He's leading off for the Kansas City Royals. Mm-hmm. He's $2,400. If you're not paying up for one of those premium guys, I don't know why you're paying anybody else except for Alcides Escobar. And he's the kind of guy... Because he's the kind of guy that's going to get on base. He's going to score runs because of who's hitting behind him. He's going to steal a base every once in a while. He's going to be in the damn lineup every single day, and he's batting leadoff. So he's going to get his bats.
Yep.
So, all right, let's go to third base.
To me, it's another power spot. Not so much as first base, but again, you can see why these guys are lumped in as middle infielders and corner infielders and whatever else. And when you look, if you cut your teeth on season-long fantasy baseball, a lot of times you could draft one of each and then one that could play both positions, and that's what, or had dual eligibility, not the guy per se, but you could draft a second, third baseman somewhere for season long. This is one of those spots again where a lot of these guys, and I'm not finding it this year to really matter much, outside of an Arenado or somebody, I'm not finding a ton of other third basemen that are just automatic power guys, not like first base.
No, they're becoming, and baseball is really becoming a you know, when we were talking about early 2000s, late 90s, we were talking about first and third base, and your corner outfield
right.
spots were your power spots, and then everything else was a multidimensional guy. Now everybody's multidimensional for the most part. You just have more power, but you're finding power at every position. You're finding power in center. You're finding power in the out or in second base and shortstop now. And it's one of those things that is extremely fun to watch. But you've got to look at it slate by slate.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have some power in your cash game lineup because unless you start going multidimensional where everybody is scoring and stealing bases and getting hits and all this other stuff, then you're not going to be able to, because there are going to be home runs.
Where I'm typically going to find my power in a cash game lineup is first base, outfield, and then third base.
Yep. I think Mike Moustakas is a great third
dude's
baseman.
Dude's on a tear.
Besides that, he's a good player.
Yeah, but he's kind of funny. He's one of those guys, tracking him last year, he can go hot and cold on me, and so you've really got to watch what he does. I like him a lot better in the low threes. When he starts getting to 4K, I'm off of him, unless he's in good matchups. And that's a lot of the case with everybody. The only one that I think is a pretty much just plug-and-play cash gameplay really is Nolan Arenado. Dude's just really, really good. And another one I would say would be second on my list would be Matt Carpenter, but he's price-sensitive. For a cash gameplay, guy bats leadoff, two holes some. I mean, he batted third last night, and I like to see the fact he didn't change his approach. But when he's in the leadoff spot, the guy hits for sneaky power. If the bottom of the order is getting on, he's driving in runs. If the top of the order is doing its thing, he's scoring runs. He's multidimensional, like you said, other than the fact he doesn't really steal that many bases. But when he gets over 4K, I start watching for matchups with him. For cash.
Yeah, he's the best third baseman in baseball.
Arenado can go over five, and I think he's still a cash play. If Matt Carpenter was a $5,000 player, I would be screaming from the mountaintops to get off of him for a while. He just doesn't produce the big points, you know, he's not going to give you a bunch of 20 and 30-point nights. He's going to give you a ton of 10 to 15-point nights. And with the upside of 25 to 30-point nights, and that's what you want in cash because he's got a floor. Arenado's got a floor, too, which is, you know,
20.
It's scary. He does. He really does have a floor. Who else would I be thinking of?
Trevor
Plouffe is a great value play when he's healthy.
Yeah, I think
Moustakas, like you'd mentioned.
Justin Turner last year against lefties. I think one of the biggest things for me is I'm more picky about my third baseman. They have to be hitting in the two spot, or they have to be hitting in the top five. They have to be hitting in either the two through five spots for cash games for me.
Okay.
Or they have to be hitting in the sixth spot with guys that have a high wOBA in front of them. You know, and he's a noted run producer. You know, if Josh Donaldson moves down to the sixth spot because the Blue Jays decide they want to get creative and put Ezekiel Carrera and Michael Saunders in the 1-2 and kind of slide everybody down and put Donaldson in that sixth spot, which I'm not saying that it's ever going to happen, but I'm just using it as an example, then, you know, Josh Donaldson would be a play.
He's the one that I left out.
You know, you've got, you know, Martin Prado, in my opinion, is a fantastic cash game short or third baseman. Anthony Rendon, when they're batting at the top of the lineup. Jake Lamb right now batting in front
of the name I was going to bring up.
You know, Brandon Drury, these two guys, because they're a platoon. Derek Dietrich, you know, these guys that hit in front of good power bats that are going to be able to score. And
two things there, not to cut you off, but let's quick fire. Jake Lamb in the two hole, cash play?
Yes.
Seven hole?
No.
Okay. Even at 2.8, you know, K, even at 2,800.
Because I can find somebody that's batting in the two through five hole that's going to be around the same price.
That's what I want people to listen to. Jake Lamb, yes in the two, no in the seven. Who was the other one that you just mentioned? Dietrich in the five, at 2,100? Dietrich in the 5 at 2,100 or Jake Lamb in the 7 at 2,800?
Dietrich in the 5, but it depends if I really, really, really need to go down that far to save money.
Okay, Kershaw's at 13K.
Yes, then absolutely 100%.
Okay, but see, now these are the things that guys need to understand, they need to listen to, and this takes a while to build up your feel for what you need to be looking for. If I put Clayton Kershaw in my lineup, I may think Nolan Arenado is the greatest cash game play in the world, but I can make a lineup where I put him in there. But the problem is the rest of my lineup is going to be really, really handicapped in a lot of their spots.
You better hope that you get 170 points from those two.
Yeah, but that's the thing is you're taking on risk. There are a lot of guys, and third base is a good swing position to be, you know, kind of talking about this kind of stuff with. Because it really depends. Moustakas in the two hole in Kansas City at 3,500 is not as attractive to me as he is in the two hole at 2,500, obviously. But there, I don't necessarily need to go looking if he's facing a right-hander that he crushes. But it's just those are the factors that you're constantly – and that made no sense what I just said. But what you're trying to factor in is – value, price, you know, opportunity, matchup, all this kind of stuff all wrapped in one. And there's a big difference in these guys around $3,000 that if they're hitting high in the order or low in the order.
Yep. And the pitcher they're facing in the ballpark.
But the cheaper they get, and that's why I brought up the Dietrich bit, the cheaper they get, really and truly, the more you can afford to punt them in cash because they don't have to do anything. I'm not just picking some 3K guy willy-nilly because he needs to actually do something for me. A 2K guy needs to do less for me, but if he affords me the opportunity to get off of a $2,700 guy and go get a $3,200 guy in the outfield that is a little bit better production spot in a little better producing matchup, I'm going to go ahead and punt third base in that case. But not very often.
Yep. All right, let's go on to outfield and we'll wrap this up here. Hour and a half. So.
What are you gonna do?
This
one's been high content though.
Yeah, it has. I think it's something that people need to go into. Outfielders. Now, outfield obviously is a generalized position because they don't specify for left, right, center,
and all that
good stuff.
Thank God.
Yeah,
you
no
don't
kidding.
Have to do that.
For me, they have to be at least three tool. They've got to be able to hit for power, drive in runs.
And throw a guy out?
The third tool is they've got to hit in a premier spot in the lineup. Or they've got to be able to steal bases, score runs, and hit for power or something like that. I don't mind dropping down to a 6, 7, 8 hole guy if the price dictates it for me to get a premier 3-4 spot in the outfield in a really good spot. Like if I want to go with a McCutchen and Marte tonight and Fowler, ooh, you know, then
that's expensive.
I'm gonna have to find some salary relief, and I don't mind dropping down to a.
That's when you're going to need a Dietrich or somebody.
I don't mind dropping down to a, you know, a Jeff Francoeur, Preston Tucker, if he's batting in that sixth spot, a Chris Young versus lefties, a Kirk Nieuwenhuis,
Seth Smith types.
Yeah, Seth Smith is my go-to. I love playing Seth Smith.
This is where Scott Van Slyke came into play last year, too.
Cody Ashe, Aaron Hicks. I mean, Franklin Gutierrez for Seattle. There's a lot of these guys at the bottom end that you can find. They're platoon guys, and you can find them hitting at the top end of in lineups in front of in premier spots where they're going to, if they get on base, they're going to score a lot of runs. And what I'll do is I'll go through and I'll look at them. Lonnie Chisenhall is a good one. you know, you've got...
You know, typical rule of thumb is pay up moderately for two outfield spots and punt one.
My favorite punt right now is Michael Taylor from Washington.
Yeah, not a bad one.
He's 2,300, and guess who he's hit in front of? Bryce freaking
Herbert. You know who my favorite one was up until last week? Angel Pagan.
Yeah.
Especially when
Jeremy
he hits in the top. Well, Hazelbecker, Jerry. He got up the fourth gate.
These guys, and don't be afraid to take a stab on these guys that are platoon players that are, you know, they get moved. It adds to their value. They're going to get more at-bats, more opportunities, especially if they're good handedness positions. You know,
because they don't play every day. Their coaches are putting them in premier hitting spots, playing the matchup with an extra fourth outfielder that is a quality guy. And so that's why you see that. And because they don't play every day, they can't go on a significant tear that's going to send their price through the roof. They're always going to be reasonably priced.
Yep. You know, Ryan Rayburn versus lefties was a phenomenal one. And he still is, except now he's about $800 to $900 more just because he's a Colorado Rocky.
It makes these guys great cash game plays.
Yes, absolutely. So, all right, that's going to do it for today. Thank you so much for listening to today's Daily Dispatch. You have your orders. Go apply them. Go make some money. Make sure you check us out this afternoon at 4 p.m. Eastern. Myself and Mr. Al Walsh DFS will be on Triple Play breaking down the full slate for you guys. I'm going to go. I'm going to spend some time with my son and do some reading and research. You're going to go have some fun and hopefully not get shot by the wife. And soldiers, dismissed.
Hoo-ah.